News, I'm Gene Randall. Reuters is reporting that the next summit meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will likely take place in early 2019. Friday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he hopes to meet his North Korean counterpart to lay the groundwork for what he called a big step forward toward denuclearization during the next summit. Since the last one in Singapore, there has been little progress reported on North Korea's nuclear pledges. Speaking with VOA in Mexico City, Pompeo said Chairman Kim had told him he was committed to the promises he made to President Trump at that Singapore event. Pompeo's words come on the heels of news that the United States and South Korea have suspended upcoming joint air defense drills set for December. VOA's Steve Miller has the story from Seoul.
The Pentagon said the decision to suspend Exercise Vigilant Ace was made by U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and South Korean Defense Minister Jong Kyung-do when they met in Singapore Friday. Vigilant Ace was last carried out in December 2017 and had been scheduled for December again this year. Pentagon spokeswoman Dana White said in a statement both ministers pledged to maintain close coordination and evaluate future exercises. In addition, a senior White House official said the next summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un is likely to happen early next year. Steve Miller, VOA News, Seoul.
Tragic news from India, where more than 60 people have died in a high-speed train accident in Amritsar, in India's Punjab state. The train barreled through a Hindu festival crowd on a stretch of tracks. The victims apparently never heard the train approach because of a fireworks display. Children were among those who died. At least 100 others were injured. This is VOA News. Central American migrants traveling in a mass caravan broke through a Guatemalan border fence this weekend, running into a wall of police on the Mexican side of the frontier. AP's Mark Stevenson was there when it all happened.
About 2,000 Honduran migrants literally shoved their way past a line of Guatemalan police and soldiers, ran over the bridge linking the two countries, and Mexico had actually closed these big steel gates to block their passage. The immigrants began shaking and rattling those gates until they broke the chains. About 50 of them were able to push through until the Mexican federal police here launched a few canisters of pepper gas that drove the rest of them back.
That was Mark Stevenson. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has been in Mexico City, where outgoing President Enrique Peña Nieto said his country was not ready to allow such an irregular entry into his country. Peña Nieto leaves office in December. And the presidents of Honduras and Guatemala are to meet today, both well aware of President Trump's threat to close the U.S. southern border to stop what he calls an onslaught. Tens of thousands of protesters, angry about the way the Brexit process is going, marched through central London today, bent on delivering a message that there needs to be a new referendum on Britain's exit from the European Union. Protesters want the public to have a chance to overturn the results of the original referendum in 2016. Hong Kong authorities have previewed a section of the Hong Kong Zhuhai Macau Bridge ahead of its official opening for traffic on Tuesday. Frank Chan is Hong Kong's Secretary for Transport and Housing.
The bridge is not just a mega transport infrastructure jointly built by Guangdong, Hong Kong, and Macau. The central authorities also attach great importance to it. With the unfailing efforts of the engineering teams, and as demonstrated by the outcome of the joint trial last month, the bridge is now ready for commissioning.
The bridge is expected to boost economic development and tourism in Hong Kong. There is fresh evidence that Russia is continuing its electoral meddling in the United States. 44-year-old Elena Kushanova of St. Petersburg has been charged with trying to interfere with the U.S. midterm elections. Her apprehension is highly unlikely since she is in Russia, which has always denied any efforts at sabotaging the U.S. political system. Kushanova is said to be tied to the Russian oligarch known as Vladimir Putin's cook. A disappointing weekend for anyone with dreams of $1 billion in his or her future. No big winner in this weekend's Mega Millions lottery in the United States. The jackpot, already at $1 billion, is expected to grow to $1.6 billion for a new drawing on Tuesday. 15 second-tier winners will get $1 million apiece. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. It's Saturday, October 20th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga, sitting in for Peter Clote.
UNMISS has identified three commanders who allegedly controlled the forces committing abuses, which it says may amount to war crimes.
The UN calls on the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition to free hundreds of civilians they abducted in South Sudan's western equatorial region.
We are sleeping in queues. There's no fuel, there's no bread, there's no drinks. Everything is, there's nothing. There's no cash, no job.
Zimbabwe's government says the country is emerging from a recent economic meltdown, but economists disagree.
The men have high rates of HIV, and the women are all very low rates of HIV, so they're sitting ducks.
That's when you get a very large epidemic. And that's what happened in South Africa.
And why is the HIV epidemic so much more severe in Southern Africa? Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet is urging the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition to free hundreds of civilians they abducted in South Sudan's western equatorial region between April and August. A report by the UN mission in South Sudan and the Geneva-based UN Human Rights Office documents horrific cases of abuse and suffering experienced by civilians in the region. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet warns the continued captivity of some 900 civilians abducted by the opposition group led by Riek Machar could have a negative impact on the revitalized South Sudanese peace process. She says the government must hold perpetrators of abuses and violations detailed in the report accountable. The report describes horrific cases of widespread abuse and gross violations of human rights, including unlawful killings, abduction, rape, sexual slavery, forced recruitment, and destruction of property. Eugene Ndorera is head of the Human Rights Division of UNMISS, the UN mission in South Sudan. He considers the abduction of the civilians very worrisome. He says he is particularly concerned about the children, both boys and girls, who have been forcibly recruited by the rebels.
I think the more important concern is about what has happened to the young girls. Girls who sometimes are only 12 years old. And they were chosen as wives for the military. They had to parade before in front of them, and then they could really choose whoever they wanted. And they used them, and they were, of course, doing the rape and also sexual slavery.
The report documents attacks by the SPLA-IO rebels on at least 28 villages, a settlement of internally displaced people, and a refugee camp in Gbudu and Tambora. It says a surge in violence between April and August caused 24,000 people to flee their homes. UNMISS has identified three commanders who allegedly controlled the forces committing abuses, which it says may amount to war crimes. It says the Sudan People's Liberation Forces, SPLA, also committed serious violations, including unlawful killings and destruction of civilian property, particularly around Negero in May. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, an international research group that focuses on problems of humanitarian assistance says South Sudan is the world's most dangerous country for aid workers. London-based Humanitarian Outcomes says 158 relief staff were killed worldwide last year, with most deaths occurring in South Sudan, Afghanistan, Central African Republic, Nigeria, and Somalia. South Sudan accounted for one of the three attacks. VOA's William Eagle report.
The new report says over the past 2 years, 103 aid workers were killed in Africa, including more than 40 in South Sudan. The Norwegian Refugee Council, or NRC, says 100 aid workers have lost their lives since conflict began in the world's newest nation 5 years ago. Nigel Trix is the NRC's regional director for East Africa and Yemen.
Many are killed in gunfire. Sometimes that can be crossfire, where they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Other times they're the victims of small armed groups who have resorted to banditry and maybe attacking an aid vehicle or an aid compound in order to for financial gain. Sometimes aid workers get caught up or become unwitting participants in conflict just because they're neutral. They help both sides, and that can cause resentment from one side or another, and they are perhaps more deliberately targeted.
The findings were issued by the Aid Worker Security Database, a project of the group Humanitarian Outcomes in London. The report notes a growing trend in the attacks on aid workers: kidnapping. Abby Stoddard, a partner with Humanitarian Outcomes, says it was first noted a few years ago in Afghanistan. She says the Taliban radical Islamic group would detain and interrogate aid workers, but release them a few days later after negotiations with local authorities.
It definitely has a lot to do with showing that they are boss in that area with intimidating aid groups that might be working there, including local and national organizations who do a lot of the aid work. But also we have heard of cases of certain payoffs, certain compromises. Maybe they want the project to operate in a slightly different location, or they want slightly different types of aid to be delivered. And these are compromises that are uncomfortable for humanitarians to make, but which sometimes happen.
Stoddard says that in conflicts with international forces, such as in Afghanistan and Syria, the kidnappers often target Western aid workers. They are trying to send a message to the West or to gain a large ransom. In contrast to these conflicts, a spike in kidnappings in South Sudan has focused on aid workers from national organizations. In 2017, armed groups there kidnapped 26 local staff, and so far this year, they've snatched 17.
And it's much more of a localized phenomenon. It's national staff. It's about the delivery of aid, and it's a crime of opportunity more often. We're going to seize control of this. We might loot the assets, or we don't want it going to this particular area. So it's a very kind of localized action, and it's not yet, and we hope it won't turn into a sort of a cottage industry for collecting ransoms the way, you know, it could in other places.
Stoddard and Trick say aid workers with national aid groups are more at risk. They are closer to the front lines and often venture into remote and hard-to-reach areas. In response to the threats, humanitarian groups have tightened security. They travel in convoys, avoid traveling at night, work in gated compounds, maintain regular radio communications, and monitor security reports. They often maintain low profiles, removing flags and agency logos from their vehicles, staff, and offices, and sometimes using local taxis to transport goods. Otherwise, Stoddard warns that continued attacks could become normalized, and that could lead relief agencies to pull back staff from rural areas, meaning fewer people are getting needed relief. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The Tanzanian man considered to be Africa's youngest billionaire has been released more than a week after he was kidnapped. Mohamed Dewji posted on Twitter from his company's MeTL Group account that he has returned home safely. It was not immediately clear how Dewji was released, whether there was a claim of responsibility, or if a ransom was paid. He was kidnapped earlier this month by two masked gunmen as he entered the Coliseum Hotel and Fitness Club in an upscale Dar es Salaam neighborhood where he was going for a workout. Dar es Salaam Police Chief Lazaro Mambosasa said the gunmen fired shots in the air before pushing Dewji into a car and driving away. Dewji heads the MeTL Group, which operates in about 10 countries with interests in agriculture, insurance, transport, logistics, and the food industry. In 2016, U.S.-based Forbes magazine estimated his wealth at $1.5 billion. Zimbabwe's government says the country is emerging from a recent economic meltdown that saw shops run out of goods and motorists spend long hours in lines at gas stations. But as Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare for VOA, economists say Zimbabwe's crisis is not over, as people have no confidence in the currency or in President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government.
For weeks now, there have been long and winding queues at most fuel stations in Zimbabwe as the precious liquid has been in short supply. Lamek Mauriri is one of those now tired of the situation.
We are really striving, but things are tough. Things are tough, especially to everyone. I don't know those who are in rural areas, how are they surviving? Especially if in Harare is like this.
How is it like in Harare?
We are sleeping in queues. There's no fuel, there's no bread, there's no drinks. Everything is, there's nothing. There's no cash, no jobs.
For a decade, the country has been without an official currency and relied on US dollars, the British pound, and South African rand to conduct transactions. In the past 3 years, however, all three currencies have been hard to find, paralyzing the economy. The introduction of bond notes, a currency Zimbabweans started printing 2 years ago to ease the situation, has not helped. The bond notes were supposed to trade at par with the US dollar, but on the black market, a dollar is now equal to close to three bond notes. Prosper Chitambara, an economist of the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, says the bond notes are partly to blame for the price increases and shortages in the country.
What is lacking in the market, in the system, in the economy is confidence. There's a distrust among economic agents of the formal economic system. The bond notes, they've contributed definitely to the current situation, the palace economic situation. Definitely they've contributed a great deal. What they've done is to increase, for example, money supply in the economy. And that money supply is not actually backed by significant improvements in productivity. That actually gives rise to inflationary pressure, the generation of inflationary pressures.
He said the government's recent introduction of a 2% tax on all electronic transactions pushed prices even higher and caused some shops to close. Damaningi Nick Mangwana, Zimbabwe's secretary in the Ministry of Information and Publicity, says the situation in the country is normal and there's no need for alarm.
There is no shortage of the oil itself. There is no challenge in terms of the production of all these essential services. That's why they are there in the shops right now if you go. There were a few people that panicked, closed a couple of shops, but those ones opened within hours. So really, yeah, there was fake news and people panicked, but it's all under control now.
That is not exactly what seems to be the case on the ground. Some shops remain closed and prices continue rising. Long fuel lines remain the order of the day. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Somalia on Sunday marked the one-year anniversary of the deadliest terrorist attack in Africa's history, a car bomb that ripped through the capital Mogadishu, killing nearly 600 people. No one claimed responsibility for the bombing, but it had the hallmarks of the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. As Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu, some victims are still suffering from the effects of the blast.
October 14 brings back awful memories for Alice Ilmi, a Somali father of 12 children who survived Africa's deadliest terror attack. On that day last year, Elmi was almost burnt to death when a huge truck bomb exploded at Mogadishu's K5 junction. Elmi was just a few steps from the blast, the deadliest terrorist attack in African history.
I said to myself, killers will come, so run away from the scene before they come for you. But my legs were broken and my head and hands were injured.
The bombing engulfed a whole neighborhood, killing nearly 600 people and leaving hundreds more, like Ilmi, permanently scarred.
My biggest worry is that the hospitals in the country can't do much to treat me. Shrapnel is lodged in my throat. It's what's blocking my voice.
Freelance Somali cameraman Al Nur Siad was on assignment for VOA when he was killed in the attack. Other victims were left with psychological wounds.
I was taken to Turkey for treatment, but the attack left a major impact on my mental health.
On Sunday, Somalis gathered at the site of the attack for the one-year anniversary to honor the victims, paying respects with a minute of silence. Somalia's Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre told the crowd the tragedy has brought the country closer together.
The terrorists believe that we could not recover from that attack and that we could no longer exist as a nation, but their hateful assault has united us more than at any other time in the past.
The memorial coincided with the execution of one of the men accused of planning the bombing. Authorities blamed the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, though it never claimed responsibility. 1 year after this shocking crime, Al-Shabaab continues to launch regular attacks in Somalia. Every time they do, Somalis pick up the pieces and do their best to rebuild. Mohammed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
It's a question that medical scientists have been trying to answer conclusively for decades. Why is the HIV epidemic so much more severe in South Africa? The United Nations estimates there are about 7 million people living with the virus in the country. Now, some of South Africa's top HIV researchers say they have proven that the relationship between young women between the ages of 15 and 24 and older men are responsible for a significant part of the world's biggest HIV epidemic. The scientists use new genetic sequencing technology to identify individuals linked in clusters of HIV transmission. From Johannesburg, Darren Taylor reports for VOA.
Okay, so how do you think you're going to disclose your status to your partner?
A nurse prepares to weigh a patient in a room in a hospital in Durban. The patient is a slender 20-year-old woman wearing a scarlet top, her blue jeans fashionably tattered, her hair a mass of braids. Her fake diamond earrings sparkle under fluorescent tubes of white light. Inside the hospital's waiting area, Amehlo, as she wants to be called, smiles shyly as she explains that she currently has two boyfriends. One's her own age, the other's 8 years older than her.
Gambona, it's how we know. Yeah.
We met in town for the first time, and he said he loves me and he can do anything for me. He hooted in the car, and I went to him.
Amehlo is from Vulindlela, a rural settlement about 130 miles north of Durban. She says before she began a relationship with her older partner, life was very hard for her. Her mother and her two sisters all are unemployed, and they'd often be hungry. But, says Amehlo, the bad days ended when she met her new boyfriend, who's a married professional.
Buy for me a new cell phone and clothes.
He bought me a cell phone. He buys me clothes, and sometimes anything that I want, I can ask him and he does it for me. He buys groceries, even for myself and for the whole family. Even if I'm going away, he gives money for the transport.
In South Africa, such older men are called blessers because they bless their young girlfriends with money and other material goods. But there's something else Amehlo wants from her older partner, something that he refuses to give her, safe sex.
He says because he does everything for me, I cannot tell him to use condoms. Having sex without a condom makes me feel sad because I do not know his status. I do not want to tell the older one to use condoms because I'm afraid that he may stop doing all the nice things that he's doing for me.
She says her boyfriend's having sex with other women and she's terrified that soon he'll infect her with HIV.
This building cost almost 1 billion rands to build.
Professor Salim Karim is the director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, or CAPRISA, in Durban. It's one of the most advanced HIV research facilities in the world. Karim says blessers have become culturally acceptable across South Africa.
If a 35-year-old knocked on my door to ask for a date with my teenage daughter, I'd kick his backside and send him packing. That person would not be welcomed in my house. It would not be welcomed in my community. That person is doing something that we would not accept. It's a community norm. We would not accept that. I had to understand in the communities that I work in that they don't have that norm. And in fact, the norm is the opposite. That it's actually perfectly fine. They accept it. It's become now part and parcel of what they live with.
This is Vulindlela, where Amehlo lives, and one of the communities that Karim's referring to. Most people here are poor. They live in mud huts or basic homes. Children dawdle along stony dirt roads. A minibus taxi pumps music on a distant hillside. CAPRISA scientists have found that more than 6 out of every 10 women older than 30 have HIV in Vulindlela. Gethwana Mahlase has worked as an HIV counselor here for almost 3 decades. She says poverty is the main reason for young women or girls having older boyfriends.
Sanitary pads are competing with a loaf of bread. The loaf of bread is going to be enjoyed by the whole family. Now this sanitary pad is for this one girl or 2 girls in the family. So which one must they go for? If you get somebody who can buy you sanitary pads, a bag of millimil, sugar, flour, then definitely you will not be prepared to starve. The blesser becomes the blesser for the family.
Karim says it's a myth that blessers are mostly middle-aged or old men. CAPRISA's research has shown that blessers are usually about 9 years older than their younger girlfriends. Mahlase agrees.
It turns out that they can be as young as 25, also as young as 20, because a 20-year-old would have a sexual relationship with a 14-year-old girl and a 13-year-old girl.
Mahlase says the older men are typically working class, having jobs in factories, for example. They don't earn much, so they don't give their younger partners lots of money.
You get somebody who's going to buy you the real basic necessities, food. It could be money to carry at school. It could be as little as 5 rands.
But, says Mahlase, the blessers are rich in danger. CAPRISA's investigation in Vulindlela shows women of about 30 are infecting men of about 30 with HIV. This is the very age group of men most likely to be blessers.
That's how they become the bridging population, transmitting HIV from older women to younger women. And they are a very effective bridge because they don't know they have HIV. They recently acquired HIV and have a very high viral load. So they're very efficient transmitters of HIV. For as long as that group of men in their 30s, serve as a bridging population between older women and younger women, you can't solve the HIV problem.
Medical machinery hums inside Professor Tulio D'Oliveira's laboratory. He is one of the leaders of the study that tracked the spread of HIV in Vulindlela using DNA sequencing. D'Oliveira says another misconception is that young women like Amehlo, who have relationships with older men, are in general sexually promiscuous.
We are talking about women with average of sexual partners of 3 in their life, but we are in a community with such a high level of HIV prevalence that even with small number of partners, you can increase your chance to be infected.
People enjoy themselves inside a tavern in Vulindlela. Some of the young women in the company of their older boyfriends. South Africa is treating 4 million HIV-positive individuals with pills to keep them alive. But, as Mahlase says, as long as poverty is pushing people to take risks, the country will fail to significantly decrease new infections. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Durban.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Netline Africa. We still have our music pot from our collection of music from across the continent. And it's now time for our Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music.
Oh, moto sijisi vibaya. Huyu mdogo anauliza eti daddy mama amehama kaya. Cha kujibu sina na baki tu kusema fanya ukanikimbia. Ni vyema ungefanya maigizo mara kumi usingenizalia. Ingali mapenzi pekee ningesema ni changamoto nijifunze. Ameniacha mpweke na watoto ni watunze. Ila siwezi mlaumu, wenda yupo sawa. Kipato changu kigumu, kutwa bumunda na kahawa. Ila mwambieni aloninyima mimi ndo kampa yeye. Kupata foreni na subiri yangu mimi atachelewe. Oh, oh, oh. Sina furaha naigiza ili mradi watoto wasijisi vibaya. Huyu mdogo anauliza eti daddy mama amehama kaya. Cha kujibu sina na baki tu kusema anawapenda sana. Atarudi, atawaletea zawadi. Atarudi mama. Atarudi, atarudi mama. Atarudi, anawapenda sana.
no, 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 Monaco, I rock a body. Dance, baby, shake, shake, yeah. I'm a hot duck, you know. Hallelujah, Hosanna, girl, you I want to. Give your body banana sweet in my heart. Oh. When you dance, you do very well. Give my love is forever. Oh. Want to sing you the makosa, oh, yeah. Where your mama do? Where your papa do? Where your sister do? Where your brother do? Come with the video, yeah. Baby, dance it like
Make me happy, yo. Only you to make me happy, yo. And if I'm ready, yo.
That was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, we thank you for joining us tonight. And please join us again tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Ngoga. This is